When Karina asked me to deliver the eulogy at David's memorial service, I asked the obvious question, why me? Just look around you and you can see why I asked. Karina explained that apart from being a long-time colleague and close friend of David's, and our families being near neighbours for many years, she wanted me because she said I was one of the few friends who always took the mick out of him. Actually, she used a stronger word than mick, but this is Westminster Abbey. So I wasn't invited today only to eulogise about David, to talk about someone who achieved so much and was much loved. I was also asked to talk about the real David, who, like the rest of us, had his human limitations. The son of a Methodist preacher, David was brought up in a very close and loving family. He had a relatively sheltered early life. Remarkably, his first night at university was his first ever away from home. He never learnt to swim as a child. He went to church three times on a Sunday, and he never touched alcohol for the first 18 years of his life. Mind you, I think we could all agree that he made up for that later. A state school boy, he went to Cambridge, where academically he was not a success. He was nearly thrown out at the end of his first year and was only saved after special pleading by his father. When he finally graduated with a third-class degree in English, he claimed he only got that because Ian McKellen let him copy his essays. It makes you wonder what degree Sir Ian got. One of David's early friends at Cambridge was Peter Cook, who he met when he got involved in the Footlights. They produced all sorts of sketches and productions together, but were rivals as well as friends. The rivalry was best summed up when Cook was asked what was the biggest regret of his life, and he said, saving David Frost from drowning. David's account of the same incident is rather different. He says Peter only saved him to avoid being accused of trying to drown him in the first place. David's first appearance on screen was with Anglia Television while still at Cambridge. No one at Anglia recognised his innate talent, and they failed to offer him a job when he left university. A decision which turned out to be the television equivalent of Decca turning down the Beatles. I assume that the executive at Anglia, who decided that David Foss was, in quotes, unsuitable for television, isn't with us here today. The irony, of course, was that within 2 years of leaving university, David was a massive star, and the rest is television history. It started, of course, with That Was the Week That Was. It is difficult to explain to young people today just how important and different TW3 was. David summed it up best himself when he wrote, "We had always been led to believe that there was a decent ruling class who wisely guided our destinies. But were they decent? Were they wise? Didn't they understand that 50s discipline, order, and authority were, in the England of the early 60s, not only stifling, but discredited, and getting more discredited every week that TW3 was on the air? Before David Frost and TW3, no one would have dared to end a television programme with the words, "So that's the choice the electorate will face. On the one hand, Lord Hume, on the other, Howard Wilson. Dull Alec versus Smart Alec." The programme only lasted 13 months, and there were just 37 editions before the BBC hierarchy announced it had to be cancelled. But it was too late. TW3 had changed both television and Britain forever. The age of deference was dying, if not already dead. Of course, TW3 was only the beginning for David, and in particular for the use of the Frost name. Within a few years, we had on television A Degree of Frost, The Frost Report, The Frost Programme, David Frost Presents, and The David Frost Show. Overkill, possibly. David also became a big star on the other side of the Atlantic. As a result, he was at one time presenting 5 shows a week in New York and 3 a week in the UK, which led one British Airways stewardess to utter the immortal phrase, "I'm very sorry, Mr. Frost, it's caviar again." It was during this period that David became much more than just a producer and presenter. He became an entrepreneur in his own right. He was one of the first people in Britain to set up his own television production company, David Paradine Productions. The first 3 artists he signed were none other than Ronnie Corbett, Ronnie Barker, and John Cleese, none of whom the BBC was convinced at the time were good enough to front their own show. David, of course, knew otherwise. He also honed his skills as a television interviewer in the succession of Frost vehicles. No one who watched it will ever forget his interview with Dr. Emil Savondra on the Frost programme, which led directly to Dr. Savondra's arrest and subsequent imprisonment. But it was in the US that David first got into heavyweight political interviewing. In 1968, he interviewed all the candidates for the presidential election, an impressive array of names from US political history, including the eventual winner, Richard Nixon, the sitting Vice President, Hubert Humphrey, George Wallace, Ronald Reagan, and Robert Kennedy. And it was, in fact, Kennedy's last interview before his assassination. Back in Britain, at the age of only 28, David put together the team who bid for and won the ITV weekend franchise, LWT. And as a result, 3 more Frost programmes were soon to hit the air, predictably called Frost on Friday, Frost on Saturday, and Frost on Sunday. Like so many of his earlier programmes, they were mainly live and inevitably controversial. It was following a grilling by David on Frost on Friday that a young Rupert Murdoch was heard to say, I was going to do this in an Australian accent, but I won't try, was heard to say, "London Weekend has made a powerful enemy tonight. I'm going to buy that blankety-blank station." He tried and very nearly succeeded. But of course, it was in 1977 that David conducted the interviews for which he will forever be remembered. Those with the by then disgraced former US President Richard Nixon. At a dramatic moment in the interviews, it was David's persistence which finally persuaded Nixon to apologize and to admit that he'd let the American people down. David took an enormous financial risk with the Nixon interviews, which he financed himself. He didn't get his money back for some 30 years, not until Frost Nixon became first a stage play and later a very successful movie. Frost Nixon, the movie, brought David to the attention of a whole new generation who knew nothing of the original interviews. As David's son Wilf said after seeing the film, "My mates suddenly understood who my dad was and just how good he was." David's career continued in the same mode. He won another ITV franchise when he put together the successful bid for TVAM. That was where I first met him, and between us we came up with the idea for his Sunday morning show, inevitably called Breakfast with Frost. The aim was to get the headlines in Monday's papers, which David then did with great success, on and off, for 20 years. One of my funniest memories of TVAM was on the first anniversary of the launch, when I decided to tell the world that the station had changed from a champagne-quaffing station to a pint of bitter place. The trouble was, I hadn't told David. So at the very moment I was telling this to the press, David was generously having a bottle of champagne delivered to the desk of every employee in the company. When TVAM eventually lost the Breakfast franchise, only David could have picked up the whole show, lock, stock and barrel, and sold it to the BBC. I cannot imagine anyone else who could have done that and got away with it. Now, in his later years, David also became a big name on the speaker circuit. And he explained to me once that if you wanted to do the circuit, you had to offer the organisers at least three different subjects you'd be prepared to talk about. It was only later that I discovered that, in David's case, whichever subject they chose, he delivered the same speech anyway. So far, I've only talked about David, the self-confessed workaholic. But of course, there was the other David. David the friend, David the father, and of course, David, Karina's husband. Now, Karina was a Frost fan from early days. Being quite a lot younger than him, she first watched him on the Frost Report while still at convent school. She developed a strong teenage crush on him. So strong, in fact, that when she first met him some years later, she was a bit disappointed. Was this really the David Frost? But after a while, romance blossomed, and Karina, being the good Catholic girl, went back to her school to tell her teachers who she was marrying. She got the predictable question from the Mother Superior: is he religious? Oh yes, replied Karina, he's very religious. He thinks he's God. They were married, a marriage which lasted for the next 30 years and quite rapidly had their three sons, Miles, Wilfred and George. And just as an aside, can I just say to the three of them, boys, your dad would have been so proud of the way you've looked after your mum in the months since he died. Back to the script. After they were married, Karina, who'd been brought up in an upper-class but thrifty family, decided that David's lifestyle was too extravagant and his finances needed to be brought under control if the family wasn't to go bust. Most of the time she succeeded, but not always. For instance, to save money, she gave herself the job of limiting the numbers who were invited to their legendary summer parties every year. David never wanted to offend anyone, certainly by not inviting them. So even when Karina did manage to knock someone off the list, they miraculously appeared at the party anyway. David always sneaked them back on when she wasn't looking. In fact, when I turned up here this morning, I thought, this looked remarkably like one of David and Karina's summer party without the alcohol. One year, I invited David to join me to watch his beloved Arsenal in the cup final in Cardiff. David, being David, insisted we had to go by helicopter from Hampshire, which he would pay for. Karina, being Karina, thought this was a ludicrous waste of money. Until on the day before the match, someone dropped out from my party and I invited Karina to join us as well. From that moment on, she thought the helicopter was the best idea ever. Now, I know this is a memorial service, but I have to say that for such a talented man who had such a brilliant career, David was not without serious shortcomings. Today, we live in a world where quite a lot of people never come to terms with new technology. David was unusual in that he never came to terms with old technology either. I was with him once when we walked past the cash machine. I said to him, "Hang on a moment, I need to get some money." He looked at me in awe. He actually said, "Do you know how to use that?" He had never used a cash machine in his whole life. And for someone who'd spent his life in television, he also struggled with television technology. If his boys weren't at home on a Sunday afternoon, he would always ring one of them on the pretense of a fatherly chat. Of course, they knew instantly that what he really wanted was, yet again, to be talked through the process of tuning his television into the football match that he wanted to watch. He also had difficulty with driving. He did pass his test, but no one ever quite understood how. For his boys, driving with their dad was one of those experiences which no child should ever have to encounter. It was Karina who finally retired David's license after he parked his Rolls Royce in a field in Hampshire. The trouble was, he took 10 yards of the hedge with him. The rest of us, drivers and pedestrians, should be eternally grateful that David had a chauffeur for most of his life. And then, of course, there were those disgusting cigars he smoked. I don't know if David knew the government had introduced a smoking ban in public places, but he certainly never let it interfere with his lifestyle, and he took no notice of it. Now, in his later life, many believe Sir David had become part of the very British establishment that he used to debunk when he was younger. And there's no doubt that was true. And yet, in his interviews, he was always ready to take on the very people who thought he had changed, and as a result, was now an easy touch. Henry Kissinger on Cambodia, Margaret Thatcher, as we've seen, on the Belgrano, Tony Blair on Iraq, and of course Nixon on Nixon. As John Major described it, being interviewed by David was like relaxing in a warm bath with a cold shower overhead, which could be turned on at any moment. Interviewing prime ministers, US presidents, and world superstars was no problem for David. He had inherited, or was given at a very young age, supreme confidence. To say David was a glass half full person would be an underestimate. His glass was always full. Even when things went wrong in his life, as they did sometimes, he was always onto his next idea, his next exciting plan, the next bit of the Frost adventure. Now, being chairman of the FA, I can't end without a brief mention of football and the legendary Sunday matches played at David and Karina's place in Hampshire. Being invited to the Foss for Sunday lunch was, of course, flattering, until you discovered that the after-lunch football match with David and his boys was compulsory. When the boys were small, it was okay. It was a gentle kickabout. But as they got into their teens, the whole atmosphere changed, and many an aging politician, journalist, actor or rock star who had just come for a pleasant Sunday lunch limped home after being clattered by one of the Frost boys. Back in 68, when David did that series of interviews with the candidates for the US presidential elections, he asked all of them a single question. What would they most like to be remembered for? I raise it only because, as you've seen, it was a question put to David in an interview relatively recently. What was interesting was that he didn't want to be remembered for his interviews, his brilliant career, or being a pioneering entertainment entrepreneur. He didn't even want to be remembered as the man who, at such a young age, changed television and in the process changed Britain. As you've heard, his answer to the question was simple. I hope I will be remembered for having been half as good a father to my three sons as my father was to me. I believe Sir David Frost, Frosty as we all knew him, was a great man and will be remembered as such. He was unique. There will never be another David Frost dominating the television industry in quite the way he did for 40 years. He is a legend. But it tells us a great deal about David that he wanted to be remembered most of all as a family man, as a husband, as a father. To me, and I know to so many of you here today, he wasn't David Frost, the transatlantic television star. He was just David, an incredibly caring, funny, generous friend. And that's how I'm sure we'll all remember him.